The lily pond consists of four sections, which I imagine sometimes as the ripples that would result if a stone fell or a frog jumped into a still pond. The innermost circle, the book's first section, describes my first psychosis and hospitalization, a very protracted and almost fatal 18 months. From that first episode, as it's sometimes called, the circles spread outward, in time and in society, to childhood and family, considered over decades in the second section, to work as a writer and as a participant in psychotherapy in the third, and finally to caring, trying to care, for my wife Heather during her own mental illness. I also think of these concentric rings in another way, as my particular story of mental illness inside the larger story of mental health, which in turn fits inside the much larger story of existence and its challenges, for some of which we use the shorthand, mental health. I can't summarize all that in 20 minutes, but perhaps I can skip a stone across these ripples, glancing off them. Or if you prefer a vertical image, let the stone slide down, descending through the ripples. Call it a slice of water. Recently, I came across a quotation that I've been turning over in my mind. It's by the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said, "You must always be puzzled by mental illness." What did he mean, I wondered. I decided it was not a statement for confusion or against certainty, but rather for curiosity and respect for the mystery of others, and against the too easy certainty. And I would broaden it. I would say you must always be puzzled by other people. Not because puzzlement is a good in itself, but because if you aren't puzzled, you aren't paying attention. And if you aren't paying attention, what can you discover that you don't already know? Every psychiatric history, no matter how long, and mine is over 35 years long now, begins with something very simple, an encounter. Typically, this encounter occurs between a doctor and a patient, maybe late at night, often in an emergency room. In one sense, this is a unique situation, but it shares features with any other encounter between strangers. Curiosity, fluctuating levels of trust and suspicion, needs on both sides, hope and fear, assumptions and expectations. What it always contains is a large portion of the unknown. Whatever knowledge and experience both persons bring to the encounter, whatever inner stars they've learned to steer by, these can't change the fundamental fact that the person facing you is unique, unlike anyone you have met before. A passage early on in the lily pond describes such an encounter. The emergency staff of North York General Hospital could not have had much more than questions on the morning of November 11, 1977, when a 22-year-old white male, agreeably calm and strangely articulate, presented with a deep transverse incision in his belly and shorter slashes across his abdomen and above his left knee. The main wound was of the size and in the place that a later examiner would ask about the patient's appendectomy. And the patient himself spoke wryly of his self-caesarean, adding that he guessed it was in the wrong direction. He also produced a thick hardbound book with a pebbly red cover, which contained some 200 pages of close-packed writing, alternating with drawings and collages. The artwork garishly colored and badly smeared in places from the artist's taste for thickly applied oil pastels. An interviewer, glancing from time to time up at the patient, riffled through the masked output, too quickly to take in more than an impression of frantic copiousness. The crucially telling point that the book had been new and empty a week before probably did not emerge. I sometimes wonder about those first examiners, whose faces I cannot remember. Where are they now? What are they doing? If still alive, the oldest would be long retired, in advanced old age. The very youngest, residents then, would be in the latter third of a career in medicine. It was 28 years ago, longer than the life of Keats. But whoever they were, and whatever little they had to go on, One thing was certain. They had to do something. The stitching up must have been in some sense soothing to both patient and practitioner. Here, at least, was an unquestioned good, an obvious need fitly addressed. Now what? The details of now what, in my case, can be found in the book. It is a long and still evolving story, ranging from drugs and electroshock to a 15-year period when I shunned the mental health system, drifting through a series of rented rooms and short-term jobs and finally disability checks. A tumbleweed life, as my friend John once called it, during which I showed the erratic motion, but also some of the spiny tenacity of that staple of Western movies. To self-prescribed drugs, both licit and illicit. To more recent years when I have made more considered use of a whole kit bag of tools, including milder drugs, diet changes, vitamins, light therapy. As I said, it is a long and growing list. Everyone has to work out his or her own program of treatment and recovery. And I do mean everyone. Recovery is a word you hear often these days, but usually in connection with a specific trauma, in recovery from addiction, from abuse, from mental illness. Whereas I think recovery, properly understood, is universal, something each person is or should be engaged in. If you think of recovery as learning how to make your wounds and losses part of your life, fully acknowledging them without allowing them to overwhelm or completely determine you, then I would ask, who is not in recovery? Who has not suffered wounds and losses? Who is not trying to live with them? Who is not facing serious challenges in the present? Who is not trying to build, out of a heap of cracked and broken, along with beautifully solid pieces, a whole life? This means that every recovery is personal, individual and changing, an ongoing negotiation. What works? It is intensely, even ruthlessly, practical. The person who wants to actively recover has to be as wily as a fox in sniffing out potential help, discarding harm, and bold enough to experiment to discover which is which. This is the search for what Pat Deegan calls personal medicine, the procedures and prescriptions that work for you. My own personal medicine cabinet is stuffed by now. I look for the new, like the mega doses of omega-3s I've got myself on now, but I also keep an eye out for old, low-tech approaches that have been abandoned in the name of progress. One of these old staples is what they used to call the rest cure, making use of the healing power of time and quiet as the wounded psyche sorts itself out. I think of this sometimes as I walk around the now disused grounds of the old Ontario Hospital, to which I was nearly sent for long-term care. I find those lawns and chestnut trees restful and restorative now. I suspect I would find them even more so in a time of acute illness. No matter how successfully it is managed, trauma takes time. Time to occur, since it occurs in waves, even if one event precipitates it, and a long time to come back from. Long, slow time is usually not on offer in an age that idolizes speed and a narrowly defined functioning. These idols of quick time get stamped out rather brutally and worshipped thoughtlessly. Time heals, we say, but do we act as if we believe it? It takes courage to trust time, the courage to wait and see. After that, of course, comes the challenge of admitting what you see and finding room to accept it. Several times each year, I experience what I call my shutdowns. These are the periods that have taught me how far beyond low mood or sadness depression really goes. They are periods when my brain and spirit, myself really, become in stages unable to comprehend or respond to much of the world. It is a lot like that famous scene in 2001, when Dave Bowman unplugs Hal, and the computer disappears, circuit by circuit. Busted right down to his programmed origins of Daisy, Daisy. Though by that time I have long since lost the urge to sing. At such times, I've learned to apply what I call the small circle cure. This means reducing activity and stimulation to a bare minimum, dimming the lights, unplugging the phone, canceling social engagements. And as I feel my ability to think in sequence ebbing away, scaling my reading down from the love life of Anna Karenina to the love life of Britney Spears. And then further down, to just flipping through books of pictures or watching reruns of The Sopranos. To return to the idea of functioning, someone seeing me lying on my side for hours beside a single lamp, flipping pages of Rolling Stone or People, might see a very low order of functioning. And it is, in a way. But it is a much higher order of functioning than I showed in the years when I tried to keep reading and writing through these spells, which can last 6 weeks or more, and added terrible frustration to depression when I could understand nothing, produce nothing. Self-acceptance, I'm coming to see, involves a better understanding of one of the simplest words, and. I am a person who reads and writes difficult texts, and I am a person who at times cannot read or write the simplest sentence. The two facts are not mutually exclusive. They mustn't be, since I'm living both of them.